Hello, thank you for attending 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium. This is session number 273, titled No More Apologies. Scholars talk about their lives after leaving apologetics. My name is Robin Linkhart, and I will be chairing tonight's session. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for approximately 3 months, beginning the end of August. Now, you're probably all veterans on our Q&A instructions, but just in case, please type your questions into the Whova app. Since we have three presenters, please note to whom your question is directed. The Q&A session will follow the presentations. A core aspect of Sunstone's mission is building a community that creates safe space for a wide diversity of people to express their faith journey. Like our tagline says, there is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us in this mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. Help us continue building the Sunstone community where all paths are given space to share and increase mutual understanding. And now a little bit about our presentation. This panel will explore the journey of former LDS apologists and scholars as they moved out of apologetics and into new arenas of their faith. We are pleased to welcome three speakers tonight. First, we have Bryce Hammond, a mystic, contemplative, former product designer, philosopher, theologian, writer, translator, and friend. He was part of the organization, launch, and management of the Interpreter Foundation from 2012 to 2017. Born LDS, he wrote for many years as an apologist at templestudy.com. Bryce went through a faith transition in 2015-16. In 2016-17, he had a major mystical experience. He now describes his faith as mystical universalist. He writes and creates community at thymindoman.com. Our second presenter tonight is Dr. Jonathan H. Westover, Chair and Associate Professor of Organizational Leadership in the Woodbury School of Business at Utah Valley University. He's the Academic Director of the UVU Center for Social Impact and the UVU SIM Lab. Previously the Associate Director, Dr. Westover is currently a Faculty Fellow for Ethics in Public Life in the Center for the Study of Ethics. He is an experienced OD/HR leadership consultant with experience transforming organizations across the globe. Dr. Westover received his bachelor and master degrees from Brigham Young University and his doctorate from the University of Utah. He serves on a host of nonprofit, community, and association boards. Radio Free Mormon spent the entire decade of the 1980s immersed in Mormon apologetics. Our third presenter tonight, RFM, had two articles published in the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies in the early 1990s. More recently, RFM had two articles published in BYU Studies. 4 years ago, RFM started the Radio Free Mormon podcast, which takes a close and scholarly look at the issues relating to the LDS Church, its history, its scriptures, its doctrine, and its leaders. RFM has produced 186 podcasts so far, and number 187 will go up this Sunday. And now let's hear from our presenters, starting with Bryce Hammond. Welcome, Bryce.
Thank you, Robin. Glad to be here. Thanks to Sunstone for inviting me to be a part of this, and glad to be here with John and RFM, and to be able to talk about apologetics, what it meant to us back when we were in it, and why we moved beyond it, and what is kind of our relationship with it now. I was thinking, you know, what's the best way of approaching this and to talk about it, and boy, the way that I came to was just to kind of go through my history and kind of explain my background and where I came from and how I got into it, and then what kind of happened that moved me out of it. And so that's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to take about the next 20 minutes or so, and each of the others will take about that long as well to share their sides. So I was born here in Utah. I have a lot of Mormon heritage, going back at least to Nauvoo. One of my ancestors was the chief stonemason on the Nauvoo Temple. I have some other links to famous Mormons like Creed Haymond, who has his story about the word of wisdom has been told several times in General Conference. So my family has been very traditional LDS Mormon for quite some time, and so I was born here in Utah, grew up in Sandy, Utah. Very traditional Mormon kind of household, very conservative. My father worked for the church in the church office building for over 40 years in the finance department. And so he was very immersed in the church and in Mormonism, and he brought that home into the atmosphere at home and brought us up in that. My childhood was pretty non-eventful, I guess you could say. I did the pretty typical Mormon things. I got my Eagle Scout. I was involved in typical childhood things, I guess you could say. Probably I was always interested in the church. I was always interested in learning more and growing in my testimony, right? And in really trying to know what God wanted for me in my life. And so I tried to study and do all the things that that Mormons are encouraged to do. And so I prepared for and went on an LDS mission where I served in El Salvador. Documentary last night of Elder Pingree really was pretty poignant, bring back the memories of serving down in Central America. And, you know, my mission went it was a pretty typical mission, I think. I served as well as I think I could have, baptized a lot of people. I served for 8 months in the mission office as the financial secretary, so I got to see really the kind of the inner workings of the mission. And everything went pretty well with my mission, and I got deeper and deeper into the doctrines and the teachings of the church and what it was all about. When I got home from my mission, I went to BYU in Provo. That's where I met my wife, and And in these first few years after returning back from my mission, I got to be really interested in the work of Hugh Nibley. And I read a lot of his materials, and I was just fascinated by how deep he seemed to be in engaging with Mormon ideas at a very kind of deep academic level, bringing in ideas from all around the world and from all different types of traditions and texts. And so that was kind of the initial spark towards apologetics. Of course, Hugh Nibley was kind of a poster child for a lot of apologetics, and really brought in an academic approach to apologetics. And so I read a lot of that and I absorbed it, and I really became interested in the temple. So I started this website, templestudy.com, where I wrote for several years about the temple and its relationship to all these other ancient traditions and rituals and texts. And I really saw all of that as evidence of the truthfulness of the church. Every single, you know, additional thing that I would find that had some kind of connection to the LDS temple, I saw as, you know, this is more evidence showing that it's true. But beginning in about 2012, I started to have doubts. And I think one of the major things that really brought it on for me was learning more about evolution, specifically biological evolution, human evolution. And I really started to struggle with this. I couldn't reconcile the teachings of the church, particularly things like a literal Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve, and the Genesis story, with what I was learning about evolution and science and the genetics and everything that pointed to this idea that life has been evolving for billions of years here on the earth. Interestingly, that was the same time when I was invited by Bill Hamblin to become involved in the Interpreter Foundation. He invited me to a lunch that we had at Olive Garden, and this was in about 2012. And Daniel Peterson was there, and Bill Hamblin, and Louis Midgley, and several other people that had gotten together. They were talking about starting this new organization, this new apologetic organization, to continue on the farm's tradition that they felt had been lost when Daniel Peterson left or was fired from the Maxwell Institute. And so I was kind of overjoyed at becoming a part of this. I was really kind of a fly on the wall there. Bill Hamblin knew me through my temple study .com days and writing. And so he invited me to help with the technological development of this new apologetic organization. And so I was a part of that, putting it together, designing the website, launching it all back in 2012. And I really feel like now, looking back on that time, I feel like I was really, because that's when I started having doubts about the truth claims of the church. I think it was kind of a last ditch effort to really immerse myself even deeper into the apologetics world and get even deeper into that scholarship. But my activities with the Interpreter Foundation, they didn't really help resolve my doubts. And Eventually, in about 2015, me and my wife decided that we were going to take a break from the church. We just couldn't reconcile it with our thoughts and feelings. So we decided to take a break. And it was one of the hardest things that I've ever done in my life, to step away from the church. But I felt like I had to do this to be kind of genuine with myself and my feelings and my beliefs. Took a step away, and a year later, decided to send in my resignation letter to the church. At about the same time, I decided to start a spiritual practice of meditation, which I had learned about in some books that I read. And this really started to open up a deeper place within me, where I felt like I began to experience on an experiential level a lot of the things that I had only talked about or thought about kind of intellectually for my entire life in the church. But through this contemplative practice of meditation, I felt like I started to experience it directly in myself. And so I started to have mystical experiences. And I had a pretty, I'd say, a major mystical experience in 2017. It was April 14th, which actually happened to be Good Friday. And I had this major mystical experience where I felt, one of the best ways that I can describe it is I felt Bryce kind of die from my mind, from consciousness. And that experience really just threw open the gates, and I felt like I experienced the spirit in ways that have been described through, you know, so many different spiritual traditions through history. And so that's really where I am now. I started this new website, thymindoman.com, in 2017, which is now where I have written over 500,000 words regarding mysticism and which I consider to be the deepest spiritual approach. I think mysticism is the source of all of the spiritual traditions, including Mormonism. I think Joseph Smith experienced the divine, and the ways that he interpreted it and translated it is what eventually became the LDS Church and Mormonism. But my approach to it now is quite a bit different than it was before. You know, now I don't see the church as the one and only true church on the face of the earth, anything like that. It's much more of a sense that there is a mystical truth in all of the spiritual traditions of the world, that they all have this kind of mystical root and origin from which they have all sprung. And my writing is about that. It's about looking deeply into these traditions, and particularly into the contemplative practices which reveal the divine to us individually on a very direct, intuitive level. So I guess that's kind of my story and my background. I look forward to talking about it more with John and RFM, and I'm happy to answer questions later on. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Bryce. We're now going to welcome Dr. Jonathan Westover.
All right. Well, thank you. I really appreciate the invitation to join this panel and the opportunity to share a little bit of my background and experience and journey with all of you today. Please call me John, and I'll try not to make my remarks too John Delinean in terms of my background and my kind of Mormon story, my history. but I will start with a little bit of background. I was born of godly parents, very LDS, very conservative. My dad worked for the church for something like 25, 30 years as a therapist and an administrator in LDS Family Services. And we moved around a bit because of his work. I was born in Ohio, grew up mostly in Oregon, and then my family moved out to Missouri later in my teenage years. And then I eventually found my way to Utah for school and ended up sticking around here for all of my grad school and am now a professor at Utah Valley University. I think I was a very good kid. I was a shy kid, and I think I checked all the boxes and I met all of the expectations that everyone had for me, because that was important to me and I wanted people to be pleased with me. But I remember even as a young teenager, I remember pushing people's buttons, and not on purpose. I would just ask questions. So I was always fairly inquisitive. And I remember specifically one time I was in a Sunday school class. I was probably 12 or 13. And I asked a particularly perplexing question that I had about a story in the Book of Mormon, because it didn't really make sense. Had to do with Abinadi teaching the priests of Noah and Alma leaving and then baptizing people. And I was wondering about his priesthood and how he did that and how he had the authority to do that. And I was asking this kind of a question in my Sunday school class as like a 12-year-old. And my teacher happened to be the director of the institute for the whole Salem Kaiser area in Oregon, and a very knowledgeable person. He'd been teaching seminary and institute for his whole career, and he didn't have a good response to it. He didn't know, and that was interesting to me. I was like, "How do you not know that?" And he actually came to my house later that Sunday evening after going home and studying a little bit, and he came to the house, and he met with me and my parents, and he wanted to give me an answer. And I remember his answer was kind of lame. And so at the time, I just remembered, you know, putting that away and just saying, I guess there really are just things that people don't have good answers to. And as I went throughout my teenage years, you know, I had many more of those types of questions, because I took the scriptures very seriously, and I took the gospel very seriously. I tried to live it to the best of my ability. I don't think I ever missed church during my teenage years. I remember there was a short stint of time where I skipped church maybe 2 or 3 weeks within 1 month when I was maybe 10 or 11, because I liked to stay home and play with my Legos. And so I claimed that I was sick, and that this really upset my parents. And so finally my parents came up with a system to make sure that I had to go to church. And so I didn't really miss after that, in part because of the parental expectation, but I also genuinely came to really enjoy it. And I've always enjoyed music. So I started to go to choir, and my ward had a good choir, and I was very much involved in music in school, junior high and high school, and even in college. And so that had meaning for me. And so really I never missed, and I took it very seriously, and I studied the scriptures seriously, but I had lots of questions. So my shelf was building. During this time, my family, where I was living in Salem, Oregon, and my parents came to us during my junior year of high school. This is probably about midway through. And they said that they had an impression that they should move out to Hamilton, Missouri. For any of you who are church history buffs, you might know Hamilton. It's kind of right in between Far West Temple Site and Adam on Diamond. And they wanted to take us out to Missouri to prepare for the second coming. And I remember them sitting us down and telling us about the dreams that they had, that they wanted us to go out to Missouri. And they framed it very much like a Lehi story. So my dad was Lehi. We were Lehi's family. We were going to journey back to Missouri, and we were going to help build up and prepare that part of the world for the second coming. And so my parents were very literal, not fundamentalist in the sense of polygamy, but very fundamentalist in their beliefs. So we end up out in Missouri that summer after my junior year of high school. And that rocked my world. First of all, I thought it was crazy. And I was really upset at my parents for doing that. And I didn't really buy into their story about, you know, why they felt directed to go out there. And all of a sudden we found ourselves out there. And turns out there were a lot of people out in our ward in Missouri who had the same story. They felt prompted to go out to Missouri to prepare the area for the second coming. And they were very literal. I remember my dad getting up in the middle of dinner and rushing off to go to Adam on Diamond because some of the members, some of the priesthood members in the ward thought that they had decoded something in the scriptures to tell them the exact spot where the Savior would return. So that was the kind of climate that I was in. And being, you know, kind of a skeptical and having an inquisitive mind at the time, and now being later into my teenage years and being willing to kind of challenge my parents a little bit, you know, that was a tough time for me. I did go to one semester of high school in Missouri, and you know, the town we moved to was smaller than my high school was in Oregon. So it was a really small town, very rural. And I went to one semester of high school and just finished early because it didn't offer much of what I wanted or what I hoped for. I ended up going to a year of college at Missouri Western State University in St. Joseph. And it was really that first semester of college that was enough to really push me towards a faith crisis. Couple that with, you know, all the context of my family. And, you know, I already had a pretty heavy shelf, and most of my friends weren't LDS in Oregon. And I had many very quite religious friends in Oregon who had shared over time pieces of different information with me. So I had a general sense of some of the different types of critiques of the church. And now that I was in college and doing more critical thinking, you know, I really just had a pretty major faith crisis. Enough so that at the end of that semester, I had made arrangements, unbeknownst to my parents, I'd made arrangements to move back to Oregon to live with a friend and to work. And that's what I did. My parents were not very happy about that. My dad thought that I was leaving and that they were never going to see me again because he thought I had gone off the deep end. But I went back to Oregon. I was living with a friend. I was working. And in that space where I didn't have parents around, that's where I really started to dig in. And I read lots of books about church history that summer, and lots of stuff. I remember reading the Godmaker books, which were kind of nonsense in a lot of ways, but they introduced me to things that, you know, that actually were real issues that I hadn't been exposed to before. And so that was my first time having really widespread exposure to a lot of that kind of context and the challenges, the issues. And all of this was happening before I would serve a mission. I had two older brothers that had already served missions. My dad had served a mission. I knew there was incredible family pressure to serve a mission, but, you know, at best, I had a very nuanced view of the church by this point. And I did return home at the end of the summer, and I did return to Missouri Western State University in St. Joseph's, and I did another semester, and then I turned 19. And I during that fall, that was a really tough time, and I had to decide what I was going to do. And ultimately, I decided, despite all of my concerns, and I had a really long laundry list of concerns, and I didn't have I didn't feel like I had a strong testimony of the Book of Mormon or of the church or anything. But I did have good experiences in the church, and I loved the music of the church. And I figured, you know, I would go on a mission, and I would serve the people, and I would focus on Jesus, and I wouldn't worry about the other stuff. And I would do it on my own terms. And so that was the framing I had as I went on a mission to South Korea. In South Korea, I was a hard worker. I was a good missionary in the sense that I kept the rules. I did what they asked me to do. I was a hard worker. I learned the language. But I always was kind of that odd missionary. And it kind of really bugged my mission president, who was a Korean man. And because I just didn't fit, you know, I was hardworking, I was productive, and I taught lots of people, and lots of people would come to church as visitors because of the teaching, but not a lot of people would get baptized. And frankly, it's because I didn't push it. You know, I didn't really care if they got baptized. And being in Korea, you know, perhaps I didn't feel as much pressure to baptize as in some other missions. So anyways, mostly I had a good mission experience doing it on my terms. I ended up returning back home. I worked for a while to save up money, and then I transferred out to BYU. I had always said that I would never live in Utah, and I was really nervous about going to BYU, but I decided I was going to do it. I ended up at BYU for 2 degrees, and I ended up working at the MTC. I taught Korean at the MTC for 3 years. And again, I was kind of that strange MTC teacher. I was always pushing back on you know, the more dogmatic and rigid teachers and administrators at the MTC, and just trying to help the missionaries see the value of gaining life experience, serving the people they taught and the people in their areas where they served. So that was kind of my approach. And then once I finished grad school at BYU, I then transferred up to the University of Utah. And that's where I did my PhD in sociology. And that's where, you know, any remnant of any kind of literal belief or buying into the system of the church, it kind of evaporated at that point, because I just had much clearer sense of the challenges, not just I'd already had a sense of the historical challenges, the doctrinal challenges. I'd been exposed to that all the way back in 1997. But now I'm really, my eyes are much more open to the social issues that were problematic in the church. And, you know, so that's where I was at that point. But I was still making it work because, you know, I was married in the temple and I had a family. My wife came from a very Mormon family, and she was very, you know, traditional in her belief and expectations. And so, you know, I was just making it work. I was doing it on my own terms. You know, I'd shelved a whole lot of things. I chalked a lot of things up to doctrine versus culture. I had a lot of problems with tons of stuff in the church, but you know, I, for the most part, it worked for me. I liked going to church. I liked being with my family and stuff. Fast forward to 2012, and I just finished a stint serving in a bishopric in a family ward, and we moved to Lehi at this point. I'd finished up my PhD. I was hired as a tenure track professor, an assistant professor at UVU. We were living in Lehi. I'd just finished serving for 3.5 years in a bishopric. And again, that was an interesting experience just because I had done it, you know, kind of in my own nuanced kind of way, living in an incredibly conservative place. And that really made a lot of people uncomfortable. But, you know, I served well. I put a lot of time and effort into it in building relationships. And so I think people could mostly appreciate that. But once I was released from that bishopric, the new bishop was not so happy with me because I was too liberal and I was too nuanced in the way I viewed things and the way I made things work. We ended up going off to Eastern Europe for a Fulbright fellowship. And I was there with my family. And that's where I had what I would call my second faith crisis. And at that point, I basically, any remnant of a belief that the church would want me in my nuanced belief and allow me to engage in the church in the way that I wanted to with my family, that kind of went out the window at that point. And so that was really hard for me. When I got back, I remember my wife and I having a bunch of really difficult conversations, and I decided, you know, this was going to be a serious issue for my family unless I figured out a way to deal with it. So I decided I was going to double down. I joined Fair Mormon. I think I'm taking too much time to tell the backstory, so let me really get into Fair Mormon. So I joined Fair Mormon, I think within a week of Bill Real. Bill Real and I became fast friends, and I joined him on his podcast several times. I joined the Fair Mormon podcast on a few occasions, and my background in organizational leadership, change management, those sorts of things, they were going through their rebranding to Fair Mormon at that time. So I assisted them in some of those types of issues. And they also, some of you may recall, they for a very short time, they had the Fair Mormon support discussion board. So Bill Real and I played a really important part in developing that discussion board and managing it. But it only lasted a couple years, and because it really rubbed a lot of the Fair Mormon types the wrong way. I didn't have any literal belief at that point. And I hated dogmatism, and I my whole approach was a more pastoral apologetic approach, where I wanted to help meet people where they're at, help people who had questions, help acknowledge and affirm their questions, help them feel validated, help them feel like, hey, there's still a place for you in the church, even despite your questions and your doubts. That was my approach. And that really rubbed a lot of the Fair Mormon people the wrong way. They put up with me and Bill for a while. They finally shoved Bill out the door. And I remember it was after a general conference, after I'd been involved with Fair for a couple of years, running the support board and part of their email service where people would send in questions and people would respond and I would help respond to questions. And I remember it was after general conference, and there was a really horrible talk. I don't remember who gave the talk, but there's a really horrible talk that had to do with LGBTQ plus issues. And the Fair Mormon group just went crazy with people spiking the football saying, yeah, sticking it to anyone who had any sort of an approach that was softer towards this community and wanting us to be more understanding and sensitive to the community. And I remember just going on this whole discussion thread in this email thread and just asking, just pleading, please do not be such assholes. And they just started piling on me. And so that was it for me. I was out. They tried to, some of this, the Fair Mormon leadership reached out to me. They tried to smooth things over. They tried to say, no, we really do appreciate you. We want you to help us. But at that point I was done. I think the other thing I should say in terms of context, I'd read all that stuff earlier, before in my first year of college, and then going on my mission, I decided in relation to apologetics, that I needed at least have some sort of answer to some of the perplexing questions that I had. And I had a huge long list. So I became very enmeshed, even on my mission, reading a lot of the farm stuff at the time. And I became that person that people would go to, if they had questions. Well, go ask Elder Westover. He can help respond to that question. That's the broader context of my involvement with apologetics. Today, I am still in the church. My family still attends. But I definitely do it on my own terms. I try to focus on the good and leave all the bad. I have very firm boundaries with my local leadership that I try to reinforce whenever possible. I remember when the recent nonsense with the honor code office at BYU happened several months back in March, that was so upsetting to me. And I haven't been shy about sharing my views on Facebook, and in social media. And I started, posting a bunch of stuff at that time. And I reached out, my kids are in seminary, my two oldest kids. And, I was just so uncomfortable with it. And, so I reached out to the seminary teachers and I just laid down the law and I just said, this is how it has to be. If my kids are going to be in seminary, I will not tolerate, zero tolerance on any nonsense and prejudice and bigotry towards the LGBTQ+ community. And it took a little bit of back and forth conversation, but I got them to commit to that they would not allow that to happen in my daughter's classrooms. I had the same thing with my local leadership. I'd already had many conversations with them, with my bishop, with my stake president over the years. But I just wanted to reaffirm my boundaries with them and with my children in their various classes. And I just wanted to let them know zero tolerance for any of that kind of nonsense at church. And I hit a little bit more resistance in the ward leadership, but eventually they came around and said, yes, that's fine. So that's where we're at. That's where I'm at. I still love the music of the church. We host choir practice at my house. Weekly, at least until COVID happened, that we would host choir practice, and I love singing in the choir. I still, every semester, again, before COVID, every semester, the Institute at UVU would invite me to come speak to the students and share my kind of my approach to the gospel and why I am engaged with the church. And I'm very straightforward and matter of fact about how I approach things, and they keep asking me back, so I keep coming. Yeah, I think I have a fairly unique approach given the place where I'm at. I live in Orem, just a mile north of UVU. It's very conservative, both politically and religiously. But I live in a good ward where we have good people that most, for the most part, show respect to my family, and so I reciprocate that to them. And I think as long as we can make the church work for us on our terms, then that's something that I'm comfortable continuing to engage with. I actually currently, I have a temple recommend. I've had lengthy conversations with my bishop and my stake president about how I approach things, and ultimately they said yes, that we're comfortable with you having a recommend. So I do have a recommend. I actually have a stake calling in the stake Sunday school, and so I try to use whatever influence I can to help people be less dogmatic, more inclusive, more thoughtful on their how they approach people with questions and doubts, because I've lived it. I've lived it since I was 18, and I have a really hard time with traditional apologetics. I have since I was younger, but I do think there's the opportunity for a more pastoral apologetic approach that would allow for us to basically acknowledge the difficult issues, validate people's concerns, meet them where they're at, help them work through the pain that they're feeling. And then if they decide that they want to stay engaged with the church, help them find meaningful ways to stay engaged on their own terms. So that's kind of how I approach things today. And I think I will end with that. So thank you. And I look forward to any questions.
Thank you so much, John. And now we welcome Radio Free Mormon.
Hi, everybody. I can't hear anybody saying hi back. I'm assuming there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people watching this saying hi back to me. It is great to be here. I'm thankful to be invited. I've got to tell you, I am actually laughing right now because I am so unprepared for this panel discussion. And the other speakers could have gone on, and that would have been fine by me. I have been working almost nonstop for the past 3 days with John DeLynn in a joint effort interview of Robert Rittner on the Book of Abraham, which is just now dropping part one, both at Mormon Stories and Radio Free Mormon. So I have had virtually no time to get ready for this. I'm so unprepared. I feel like Daniel C. Peterson getting ready to address the Fair Mormon Conference. That's how unprepared I feel like I am here today. But I do have a few things to talk about. First off, it is hard for me to explore my entire journey from being a devout LDS apologist, which I definitely was back through the entire 1980s, to where I am today as Radio Free Mormon. There is a huge arc there in that story, and I can't go through all of it, but I will hit on a few points that occur to me. By the way, I think most of my listeners know that I did an institute class. I taught a legitimate institute class at the Institute Building at the University of Texas at Austin in the spring of 1989 of my own making and with the approval of the institute director, 12 classes on defending the faith, i.e. Mormon apologetics. And so those are my bona fides for being an apologist. I now have at radiofreemormon.org over 185 episodes, and there I am using whatever analytical gifts God has given me to try to shine a light on the many areas of Mormonism that church leaders would prefer remain in darkness. So how did I get from there to here? I will tell you that at one point toward the end of the 1980s, I seriously believed, I could prove Mormonism true beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I was probably thinking in legalistic terms at the time because I went to law school from 1986 to 1989. And at this time, in 89, I'm just graduating. My head is full of law. My head is full of Mormon apologetics. And I'm really thinking I can make a contribution here. And in fact, I would write a book. This was my idea. I would write a book. I even had the title picked out. And I would call it Truth, Diamond Truth. And if those of you who know Joseph Smith can pick out that part of a quote from Joseph Smith, then you go to the head of the class. Truth, Diamond Truth would be the name of the book. But just as I was contemplating this wonderful venture, a number of things happened to throw a damper on the project, especially in 1989. Although I was still a devout apologist, even then, this isn't something that you just turn off like a hose, at least not for me. I began to realize that many of the arguments that I was making in defense of Mormonism were not as strong as I had previously believed. The problem was that I continued to study. See, I kept learning and I kept researching. That was my big mistake. If I had left it where it was, I could have just continued to be an apologist for the rest of my life and never learned anything new. But that's really the tension that goes on, at least in my life, between being an apologist and growing and learning and graduating from becoming an apologist into becoming a seeker of truth, is this idea of you can either not grow and remain an apologist, or you can grow and not be an apologist anymore. At least that seemed to be the two choices that I was faced with. I also began to become aware at the time, I was also this kind of guy that I wanted to be the Book of Mormon answer man. I wanted to be that guy that when people had troubles with the church and they were reading anti-Mormon literature or people were talking to them about bad things about the church, I was the guy. I wanted to be on the other end of the bat phone when they picked it up and said, hey, I got a problem. I need some help here. And I would say, I'll be right over. And I would take care of the problems. Yes, I wanted to be that guy. But I also began to be aware gradually that the success of my arguments defending Mormonism depended on the other person not knowing the counter argument. This isn't true with everything, but you know, it starts to dawn on me that, wait a second here, I'm kind of playing a game here. And my argument depends on them not knowing the counter argument. Now, of course, on the off chance that the other person did know the counter argument, I had a backup plan already in place to counter the counter argument, right? But that position, if I have to go to the point where I'm countering the counter argument, that position is going to be much weaker than the presentation would seem if I didn't have to go there to the counter argument. So basically, I'm depending upon the other person not knowing as much as I know, and therefore being able to present Mormonism as more strongly and more correct than if they did know what I knew, if you know what I mean. And so ultimately, I start seeing that. Let me go back to my notes. I made some notes here. I don't want to go off totally off script. But I also began to learn that if I had an answer, any answer, that's what was important. Not really whether that answer was personally satisfying to me, okay? So I just had to be able to say something. And if I was able to say something, anything in response to an answer, then that seemed to be all that was necessary at first, right? And this is like the character Mephistopheles in the book Faust, where he is quoted as saying, men usually believe, if only they hear words, that there must also be some sort of meaning. So it's like this idea that if you just spout some words, then people think, well, if he's saying words, there must be some meaning to it. And I'm not going to get into a long involved digression here, but my gosh, hundreds and hundreds of pages of Nibley. I can't think of a better definition of my experience reading Hugh Nibley, at least most of Hugh Nibley, which is that men usually believe, if only they hear words, that there must also be some sort of meaning. Well, maybe there's some sort of meaning that he was trying to get across, but it certainly wasn't coming across to me because I couldn't make heads or tails out of what he was talking about. But I did think this is obviously a smart guy, and therefore, if he believes Mormonism is true, it must be true. Okay, so I began to see that Mormon apologetics wasn't about growth, personal growth, me growing through learning new things. It was about defending a predetermined set of truth claims, a dominant narrative, if you will. And it was kind of like being a lawyer, which is kind of funny because that's what I am. 30 years now, I've been a lawyer. But it started striking me that being in Mormon apologist was like being a lawyer, because what I'm doing is I'm arguing a case. My job isn't to find the truth. My job is to represent my client. And my client in this case is the Mormon Church and Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham and everything else that goes along with the Mormon Church. And all of my abilities, all of my analytical skills, all of my smarts and knowledge must be used for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to defend my client's position that the Mormon Church and the dominant narrative is true. Now, on the other hand, it is not like being a scholar. Being a lawyer is not like being a scholar. It's not like being a scholar whose job is to find out what the truth of the matter actually is. In fact, being an attorney or an apologist for a certain position is pretty much guaranteed to prevent you from finding out what the truth is. That is, unless you start out with the conclusion, you start out with the conclusion that you already have the true position. But then, I'm so sorry here. Actually, I'm confusing myself here. I typed up these notes hurriedly. I'm not sure that I typed them up correctly. Let's put it this way. The whole deal with being an apologist is you start out from the beginning knowing the conclusion, right? You already know what the conclusion is. When I was baptized into the church in 1978, I knew what the conclusion was. The conclusion was the church was true. Joseph Smith was a prophet. The Book of Mormon is the word of God, etc. And I didn't even know anything about the church yet. So everything after that is going to be fitted into that construct. Everything I learn is going to be bent to proving that my conclusion that I already accepted at the outset is true. And of course, this is the idea that Sherlock Holmes pokes holes into when he says, it is a capital mistake, Watson, it is a capital mistake to begin to theorize before one has all the facts. Insensibly, one begins to twist the facts to fit the theory instead of the theory to fit the facts. And this is the problem with apologetics. It's the problem with so much outside of Mormon apologetics. I mean, it happens in other religions. It happens in politics. It happens in pretty much everything where people have a predetermined belief and a commitment to that belief, that they want to defend that belief. And then they're going to start using all these confirmation bias kind of ideas to filter the information, to accept the information as true that supports their belief, and to disregard or discount any information that undercuts or contradicts their belief. But going from being an apologist to being Radio Free Mormon is the process of personally recognizing that, not only in other people, that's easy. Recognizing that in other people is easy, but recognizing it in myself, that took years and years. And it was a slow and sometimes painful process. Now I'm looking here at my notes and I'm thinking that I'm going to skip this part about Plato's cave. And I'm going to go to this part where I talk about growing up and expanding and becoming more knowledgeable instead of less knowledgeable. I have a book of quotes that I write from books or plays or whatever it is, Shakespeare, that I'm reading. And if something strikes me, I'll write it down. I also have some places in there where I write down personal insights that come to me. And back on March 2nd, 2014, I know because I wrote the date next to it in my book, this idea came to me. I think I was sitting in church at the time, probably sacrament meeting, and this is the thought that came to me. The church is a boy's suit, too tight for me now that I am growing up. So this is the idea that came to me. I'm starting to grow up. I'm starting to become a bigger person. That's a good thing, right? Boys are supposed to grow up. Things that are living and alive are supposed to grow up. They're supposed to change. That's considered a good thing normally. That growth and change is a good thing and should be encouraged. But of course, on the other hand, the church as an institution tends to work against this idea among its members and keep its members infantilized because that's the way they like them. That's why it's led me to come up with this other quote of my own. In the LDS church, we never really graduate from primary. The things we learn in primary, we're going to be learning, quote unquote, learning the rest of our lives in church, because really, you never graduate from primary. And in fact, I think I got about 5 minutes, maybe 6 minutes left. John Gee just yesterday There was an interview with him on a Fair Mormon Interview. Went up yesterday. I listened to it driving to work this morning. And he's talking about Brian Hauglett. And I think all the listeners know who that is. And if not, please look it up. I can't actually go and describe all this. But he's talking about Brian Hauglett. And John Gee is talking about how John Gee, his own position on the Book of Abraham, has been consistent. But that Brian Hauglett's position on the Book of Abraham has changed over the past 10 or 11 years. And the amazing thing to me personally is that John Gee is saying that like it's a bad thing. Like it's a bad thing that a person's opinion would change over 10 years, and that it's a good thing that a person's opinion doesn't change but remains static. And I think that illustrates so well this point I'm trying to make, that you can be an apologist and remain an apologist and remain unchanged, unstunted, ungrowing, or you can be a person who's more of a scholar and escape the cave of Mormon apologetics and become bigger, grow, learn, actually find out where the heck the truth leads to. And it's a wonderful, it's an exciting adventure. At least it has been for me, and I think for everybody else that I've met. Oh my gosh. Okay, so I've got like 3 minutes left. Let me go off on this brief detour and talk about how exciting it has been. I am 60 years old now. I am having the best time of my life ever. In 40 years in Mormonism, I'm having the best time of my life ever now with all of the things, not just that I'm learning personally, but that I'm able to learn personally, but all the people who are similarly minded to me that I'm able to meet and rub shoulders with and have conversations with. And I don't want to give a list because I know I'll miss people, but first and foremost is Bill Reel. There's Jonathan Streeter. There's all sorts of people. Once again, I know I'm going to forget people. I've even been able to interview people. My gosh, I can't even imagine that I'm able to interview people. Like there was Carolyn Pearson I've interviewed recently. There was Brian Hauglett. I interviewed him. He was nice enough to come on the show. And most recently, Robert Rittner. I'm interviewing Robert Rittner. It's incredible to me. So I'm having the time of my life. I feel greatly blessed to be in this position. And this is the difference to me between being a Mormon apologist and then growing up, leaving the cave, and being able to actually investigate things, learn things, grow, expand, and find out, frankly, what true happiness is. I always heard in the Mormon church that true happiness is found only in the Mormon church. You can't find it outside the church. That's fake happiness out there. Those people, they just look happy, but they're really not. They're really miserable. I found out that's not true. For me personally, and only speaking for me personally, the truest happiness I have ever found is outside the LDS church. So I think that's about all that I have. No, let me go ahead and close this with one of my favorite quotes from Walden, from Thoreau. There are none happy in the world, but beings who enjoy freely a vast horizon. There are none happy in the world, but beings who enjoy freely a vast horizon. And I see that I may have one more minute left. So let me close this with one of my quotes. This is one that I did myself. This is another idea that came to me when I was in church. This is back from August 20th, 2013. Isn't that funny that I can actually tell you what the dates are because I wrote them down at the same time? This is based upon the idea that I had heard, because when I joined the church, Spencer Kimball was the president of the church. Great guy, you know, so many wonderful attributes about him. But he gave a talk that stuck with me where he likened members to horses. And he said, we want members who are plow horses, not members who are race horses. Because plow horses, they'll just chug along all day, day after day after day. And a race horse will go really fast for a short period, and then it can't go anymore because that's what a race horse is bred to do. And he said, he said that in the church, we want plow horses for members and not race horses. And thinking about this, this thought came to me, and this will honestly be the end quote here. Okay. This is a quote came to me. Based upon this. Here we go. God wants plow horses and not race horses. So we are told. But what I think God wants most of all is to have winged horses. And that's it Thanks, everybody, for listening. I guess I'll hang around for the Q&A, and I appreciate being here.
All right. Thank you so much, Radio Free Mormon. And I am going to assume that Bob is going to put all of us on the board in tiles for the Q&A. We have several questions in the queue. I'm going to start with some directed ones first. And Bryce, this one's for you. Bryce, our paths are quite similar. Have you written about your mystical experience on your site?
that's a good question. As anyone that's familiar with mystical experiences knows, they're very hard to describe. They're often described as indescribable, ineffable, beyond words. They can't be put into language and still kind of capture the essence of what it was. I've tried to write about my own experience, but the words just didn't come. The words seem so weak, and like they don't capture what it was. And so I haven't explicitly or directly talked about that experience that I had on Good Friday in 2017. What I have written about, though, and I've now written, like I said, over 500,000 words on the site, I feel like in engaging with all of the mystical literature out there through history and the mystical traditions that are alive today, and talking about them in this way, I am talking about my own experience too. There's a famous quote that goes, theologians may quarrel, but the mystics of the world speak the same language. And I really feel that's true. And so whenever I write about mysticism from any perspective, I feel like I am expressing different aspects of my experience. And maybe someday I will try to put my own experience down to more concrete terms, but that's where I'm at right now.
Thank you, Bryce. Here's a quick one for you, John. When were you in South Korea? I was there 88 to 90. We must have known each other back then. I was Elder Slade.
I was there 98 to 2000. So a little bit later, but I'm sure it would have been great to know you.
And now a more serious one for you, Jonathan. Do you have a concern about a disciplinary action with you admitting a lack of literal belief, as you have said?
Who knows? I mean, it's possible. But I've been pretty open and straightforward for years, and nobody's sought any sort of action against me during that time. So I doubt it, but I suppose it could happen. I'll say that the quickest way to get me and my family to completely disengage from the church would be to take disciplinary action against me. So if that's something that a local leader decided they wanted to do, then I certainly that's within their right, and we wouldn't put up with that. But to my local leader's credit, they've honored our wishes and they've respected our boundaries. I attend any interview that any of my kids have ever experienced with any leader. I've always been sitting right beside them in the room, and this was long before the church came out with kind of the revised policy on that matter. So, those are the types of things that I've asserted myself on for years, and they've honored our wishes. So as long as they honor our wishes, and we can do things on our terms, then that's okay. I just don't see it likely that anyone would come after us, but you never know.
Thanks, John. So Radio Free Mormon, I want to report to you that among those thousands of fans who are here for you, we did have a few register their comments. Yippee ki yay. Hi, RFM, and can't wait for your next podcast post. And so I thought we would send this one that's not designated to one of the three of you for you first, Radio Free Mormon, and then we will check in with Bryce and John to see if they have anything to add. So here you go. Why do you think some brilliant intellectual people remain traditional members? For a few years, what kept me active was feeling there's no way these people, including my mission president, could be wrong.
Well, that is a really good question. And I will tell you something that I have learned as being a defense attorney and representing all sorts of people, most of whom are unjustly accused, I must say. But they're charged with criminal offenses, right? And you look at people and the way they do things, and you think, I would never, ever do something that way. What it's led me to understand is that there is no way for me to judge how somebody is going to behave, because you know something? Different people do things differently. And I certainly was a devout and observant member of the LDS Church for many years, even when I had severe doubts and interior dialogues, or actually if it's interior, I hope it's a monologue. If it's a dialogue, I'm probably in trouble. But in talking with other people as well, who have similar thoughts. And so, you know, I cannot sit here and judge other people. And I would never say that someone is unintelligent because they are faithful, observant Mormons. How can they do that? I don't know. All I can say is different people do things differently. But ultimately, you go from the point, or at least I did, where you put your faith in other people who are smarter than you to know what is right and know what is true, and therefore you can follow that to a point where you grow up to a point where hopefully you begin to start taking that authority from other people and bringing it into yourself to make your own decision. That's another of my favorite quotes from Thoreau, which is, just because somebody else can do your thinking for you doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good idea.
Thank you, RFM. I'm going to read the front end of that question once more, and then I'll turn to Bryce and then John to give any reflections you might have. Why do you think some brilliant intellectual people remain traditional members?
Well, it's a good question. And like RFM said, you know, it's hard to know why. There might be many, many different reasons why people remain members. You know, it could be a social aspect. They want to be part of the community. I think that's a real strong one for a lot of people. They don't want to, you know, leave the community. They want to be a part of this community that they've grown to be a part of. You know, I thought Hugh Nibley was pretty smart. And one of the reasons why I liked to read him was because I thought he was so smart. And it, eventually the arguments just started to not make sense to me. They just started to not hold water. It's like they just started getting, you know, holes punched in them, and everything started to drain out. And I guess maybe for some people that doesn't happen. They're able to hold on to some of those arguments as good reasons for certain church teachings. But for me, they didn't hold together like that. So that might be, you know, another reason.
Thank you. John?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Bryce and RFM both already said, people are complex. I mean, there's so many potential ways that people make sense of things, and you add in confirmation bias and, you know, how people have mental, you know, they create mechanisms to deal with the cognitive dissonance. And so lots of people put things on the shelf and they compartmentalize. And, you know, they know that something doesn't feel right, but they find meaning. They love the community. They find meaning. They feel like they've had answers. So even though they can't reconcile this historical thing or this doctrinal thing or this social issue within the church, they feel confident that overall it still all has to fit. It all has to make sense. And so I think that's how a lot of people end up doing it. And, you know, I've known lots of, well, I still know lots of really super intelligent, smart people who are in the church. But there's a whole spectrum, you know? And so to say, like, I don't even know quite what the writer of the question means. We'd have to ask them to define what they mean by a traditional member, because I'm not sure what that is. I'm not sure who that traditional member is. I think the vast majority of people who show up to church on Sunday aren't probably what that person might have meant when they asked the question, because I think lots of people have doubts, lots of people have questions, lots of the people are there for mixed reasons. I think it's actually a fairly small subset of those who attend weekly who actually are fully orthodox and dogmatic in how they view everything. One of the reasons why my situation has been able to work is I'm very heterodox, but I'm very orthoprax. And so, you know, I don't care to do the things that the church says I shouldn't do. So I don't make people nervous in terms of my behaviors. I do all the things that any, you know, kind of believing Mormon, you know, would traditionally do. And I don't do the things that they wouldn't do. And so, you know, I have all the unique stuff going on in my head, and I share some of that from time to time, and that makes people uncomfortable, but largely people are okay. And you know, I think most people have nuanced ways of viewing lots of things. You know, and it may not come out in a testimony meeting on a Sunday, but you get someone in private and you start to talk to them and you start to uncover their questions, their doubts, their unique beliefs that are different than the standard, you know? And yeah, so I think there's a big difference between orthopraxy and orthodoxy, and yeah.
Thanks, John.
Robin? Ah. I'm so sorry. Just to butt in, I just had a really, really super intelligent guy who wishes to remain anonymous on this point text me his answer to the question, where he says his answer to the question is this: because if you're raised on a diet of bullshit, then you never realize what you're eating.
Well, thank you for offering that culinary delight.
I think, you know, if I can chime in too again.
Sure.
I think, you know, like RFM shared the allegory of the cave, that's a really apt way of looking at it. And I served in South Korea. I love Korean proverbs. And one that's common in Korea and in Japan and other parts of Asia is the frog in the well. It's basically the same meaning as the allegory of the cave. But essentially, you have people that don't know any different. If you're born a frog at the bottom of a well, that's your whole existence. That's your whole world. If you never come out of the cave or you never come out of the well, you don't know what you're missing. You don't know what else is out there in the world that you haven't experienced. And people like safety, they like security, they like certainty. And it takes a lot to get someone to put all of that aside and embrace, you know, the messiness and the complexity, you know, the uncertainty and the ambiguity of the world.
All right. Anything else on that one? Don't want to leave anybody out. Okay, this next one will go to all of you, and each of you touched on this a bit in your sharing time. So I'm going to frame this in one sentence or two. How do you describe your current belief, disbelief, and church doctrines, scripture, truth claims, and history? And let's let Bryce start.
Well, as I said, I'm no longer a member of the church, but I still consider myself kind of culturally Mormon. I was born into it. It's in my blood. I think I'll always be kind of culturally Mormon. I'm still fascinated in Mormonism, and especially kind of the roots of it, the origins in the mysticism of Joseph Smith, which I've written about extensively. I don't think the church is the one true church on the face of the earth, which is kind of what I grew up believing. I think it has truth in it, which is a very different way, I think, of approaching the church. I think most churches or religions have truth in them. They are pointing to truth. The ways that they express the truth are kind of relative or partial or imperfect, but they're all trying to point towards a more absolute type of truth, but they can't articulate that directly. It's kind of impossible to speak the absolute truth. And so they point to it. And I think that's what Mormonism also is trying to do. I think Joseph was interpreting or translating his experience of the divine in the ways that he had been conditioned as kind of, you know, this New England American kind of folk magic guy. He interpreted in the ways that his mind was conditioned to interpret it all. So that's kind of at a general level. As far as like the scriptures, the Book of Mormon, I don't think it is a historical, literally historical. I think it came out of the deep contemplative consciousness of Joseph Smith from a very deep place in his mind and consciousness. And I still think it's inspired because of that, where it came from. But I don't think it's the literal word of God. I don't think it's literally historical. I think it taps into kind of a perennial tradition, perhaps, also called ancient wisdom. But that's not because it's literally ancient, but because it taps into this more perennial spirit of what is the divine, what is the transcendent, the absolute. You know, what is it that we're this kind of telos that we're being drawn towards. So anyway, those are kind of some of my thoughts about the church. I've actually written a number of articles on my website, thymindoman.com, where I try to reconstruct a new kind of a narrative of Mormonism from a more mystical point of view. And so that might be interesting for some people to take a look at.
Thanks. And thanks for reminding us of that website. That's going to be a go-to for a lot of folks after this session. And Jonathan, what about you? How do you describe your current belief, disbelief, and church doctrine, scripture, truth, claims, and history?
I'm a very proudly self-proclaimed Zen Mormon Universalist. I've declared myself that now for probably at least 8 years. And it sometimes makes people a little uncomfortable, but for the most part, I think it's fine. I have a nice Buddha out on my back deck, and people seem to be okay with that for the most part. I would say I'm a hopeful agnostic, and I live my life as though I believe God were there. But I certainly don't know God is there. I've had what I would consider some powerful mystical, spiritual experiences in my life that I can't explain. So I behave, I live my life as though God is there, and I hope that God is there. But that's about the extent of that. And as I already mentioned, you know, I'm very orthoprax, but I'm not orthodox really in any sense in terms of the truth claims or the traditional teachings or beliefs of the church. And I have very serious issues and concerns that I regularly push back on in terms of social issues and how they're handled in the church. So that's me.
Thank you, John. RFM, take it home.
There we go. I just unmuted myself. I was having a little trouble there. Sorry about that. Yeah. So here's what I think. I think that Joseph Smith, when I read Joseph Smith, he seems to have been always wanting to keep things open theologically to new possibilities. He hated creeds. He hated the idea of creeds because he said they set up stakes and say, hitherto shalt thou come and no further. He hated them so much that he even put in the mouth of Jesus Christ in the 1838 account of the first vision, calling the creeds an abomination, and the professors of those creeds are all corrupt. That's how much he hated creeds. So ironically, what's happened now is that the LDS Church has become so creedal, so rigid, so petrified, so moribund with doctrine and basically a very creedal system that it has become, in effect, and ironically, exactly the kind of church that Joseph Smith originally came to overthrow. And when I think about dogma, I always think about one of my favorite people, Alf, from the 1980s sitcom, when he talked about dogma and he said, yuck, that's dogma. No, it's worse than dogma. That's dogmanure.
Got it. That's pretty clear. Thank you. Jonathan, here is a practical application question for you.
Yeah.
Hang on just a second. So regarding your request to your local leaders to refrain from saying anything disparaging about the LGBTQ community, what exactly did this look like? How did they agree to handle discussions about church teachings that are harmful to the LGBTQ individuals?
Yeah, good question. Well, I'll say first, when I sent this, I'll call it a request, but it was more of a demand. When I sent this kind of boundary line in the sand request to my bishop and the ward council, everyone was included on the email. I didn't hear anything from him for a week. So this was in contrast to the seminary teachers. When I did the same thing, we engaged in discussion immediately, like within a half hour of me sending the email. I think it made the leaders very, very uncomfortable, and they didn't really know what to do with what I was requesting. And at one point, the bishop, who is a man I really appreciate, he's a thoughtful man, a good man. But he responded, you know, that he felt very uncomfortable with my email, and he felt like I was choosing to be offended before anyone had done anything. And you know, I just said, no, this is a matter of boundaries. It's a matter of, I don't expect my kids to be in a complete bubble. You know, we're a very liberal home. They hear from me and their mom regularly about all these issues. But we live in Utah. We live in Utah County. So I know they're hearing from their friends, and I know they're hearing from people at school, teachers, about, you know, all sorts of things all the time. I don't expect them to never hear, you know, the more concerning types of views on whether it's racial issues or LGBTQ plus issues or whatever the case may be. So, you know, I told the bishop, you know, I understand that things might come up, like things could be said. You can't control what people will say. You can't control what someone's going to say over the pulpit, you know, in a given talk or in a lesson or a testimony. But you can create clear expectations amongst the membership about what is acceptable types of behavior, dialogue in those settings. And for teachers, you know, so in my role in the Sunday school and trying to help frame, you know, effective teaching, like there's no place for any of that nonsense in having meaningful, uplifting teaching in the church, I believe. And so I am not shy about saying that. And I'll say that over and over and over again. And so I express that to the bishop. Like there really is, especially for kids, for my primary age and young women age kids, there's no place for any of that. It should be Christ-centered. It should be service-oriented. And anything beyond that, I'm not comfortable with. And if something does come up, something does come out, that we will address it in my home for sure. And I'll help the kids know that we completely disagree. They know that I think that the many of the brethren in Salt Lake are bigots. I'm not shy about sharing that perspective with them. And I will say the same thing if someone in our ward says stuff like that. But I also want the bishop and ward leadership to know that, you know, if someone says something offensive, it's not me choosing to be offended. It's them doing offensive things and saying offensive things. And so it should be addressed. And that I would have that expectation that it would be addressed. And if there are any sort of persistent issues, that should be dealt with. It's not okay for people to express bigoted views or prejudiced, racist, sexist views. And I'm going to do everything I can to counteract that in my home, by the way we teach our kids in the home. If there comes to be consistent types of experiences like that at church, then we're just not going to go. We're not going to attend. And it took a little bit of back and forth and pushback, but you know, they agreed to that. And I believe them because they've honored our wishes and our boundaries up to this point. So I do think they'll make a good faith effort.
Thank you. So we have two more questions, and I'm not sure how deep you can go in your response to these. So I will read the first one. Do you have firsthand knowledge that any of the current active apologists at BYU or FAIR have doubts or disbelief? Are there any more Brian Hoglids out there?
I don't. You know, in my discussions with you know, just average people with members, there's lots of members that are questioning things, that have lots of doubts. But you don't, at least in my experience, I haven't gotten into those kinds of doubts with other apologists necessarily, maybe once or twice. But no one, you know, major from BYU or Fair Mormon that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I mean, I would say none of the big names that people probably think of usually when they think of the apologists. But I think there's lots of nuanced believing apologists and lots of people who compartmentalize stuff. I saw that all the time behind the scenes at Fair Mormon. And there were many people who left Fair Mormon the same way I did for the same reasons, who also had similar ways of viewing things. But I mean, even with some of the most outspoken apologists, you get them into some of these unguarded moments behind the scenes. And I've heard many of apologists, even some of the bigger name ones, express questions or doubts or whatever. They would never say that openly to other people because they would worry about hurting their faith, but yeah, they have questions.
RFM, do you have anything to throw out on this one?
There are so many of them out there. In fact, I was talking to Bill Real just earlier this morning, and by the way, Bill Real was one and sort of became one when he was there at Fair Mormon. Jonathan sounds like he was also another example, working at Fair Mormon of all places, the bastion of apologetics, and this is the truth, and we will prove it to you by hook or by crook. And Bill Real was telling me this morning, he was actually starting to laugh because he's starting to list names of people, and these are big name apologists with whom he has had, and even an apostle, by the way, with whom he has had personal correspondence and conversations privately, where they have told him things in private that they have told him they would never say publicly or to other people, because, I mean, frankly, Mormonism makes cowards of us all, doesn't it? When we're apologists, it makes cowards of us all because we cannot say what we really think, what we really feel. My goodness, there's a certain fellow, I don't know if you've heard of him, he's a Mormon, he's a historian, his name is Richard Bushman, who ended up getting videotaped when he's giving sort of a private little comment to a small group of people talking about the dominant narrative is not true. And that went public, and he spent the last several years trying to walk it back and say, no, that's not really what I meant when I was talking to this group of people. So yeah, they're everywhere, I think. I don't want to say that everyone is that way, okay, because I don't know their hearts, so I can't say everyone, but they're out there, and they are legion.
Okay, we are at the end of our time right now. I want to thank each of you for sharing with us today on this session. And to those who are listening, thank you for attending and for supporting Sunstone. Don't forget to check out the community chat boards. If anybody has interest in continuing this conversation, tag one of these gentlemen and you get yourself a conversation going. And do not forget, you do not want to miss our evening keynote at 7:30 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time with Fatima Sala. Thank you for supporting Sunstone. Have a great rest of your day. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.